as a parent I need to be aware of.
To say it on that note, we'll go on a quick break.
I am a Muslim, Islam my deen, Allah my Lord, His word Quran, Muhammad Prophet, peace be upon him. I am a Muslim for all of time. Someday, somehow, my journey here will end. I know not when Allah will call me home. This life I live, oh, what a blessed thing. As death comes to me, these words I will sing.
Welcome back, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. You are now listening to the program Islamic Upbringing. Today we are discussing how important it is to help our children when they are going through all the various circumstances and problems of life, and how we should, as a parent, be proactive and not simply reactive. Mm.
So we, from this point, we get to say that sometimes when it comes to us as parents or educators, that we get into a collision course with children, and even whether they're children or teenagers, we have this collision and we have this misunderstanding, and sometimes it leads to a fight, sometimes it leads to children leaving their homes, it leads to a lot of things. It's only because the child is suffering from something that the parents are not aware of.
Right.
Especially when it comes to, for example, mental problems. Now, a lot of people don't take that mental issues seriously. Now, it's just amazing now we have so much terms for children like DDHD, CDD,
right.
I don't know, like
the
list just goes on of mental problems that kids have these days.
So many disorders.
So many disorders, like you said, that even, you know, just long names that children are facing these days. And most of the parents are either oblivious to that fact, or they just say, well, no, I don't think my child has it.
Right, it's not going to happen to my child.
It's not going to happen to my child.
Right.
And then when they realize that the child himself, he actually has it, the parent doesn't know how to deal with it.
They
and
panic.
And not they just
overcoat.
Panic, they have this collision. Then they, you know, they clash with one another because the child feels that he's not understood. He feels that his problems are not being at least accepted by his parents. So it would make him do something completely different. It would make the child do and act on his own accord. And you know how destructive that is, because he's a child at the end of the day. He doesn't know, he cannot differentiate between right and wrong and good and evil, at least to this stage. So he would go towards, you know, anything that could get him out of his environment, out of his, you know, the problem that he's suffering, the problem that he's going through. So we go back to the parents and we say, well, you need to understand that children have problems as much as you do. Maybe their problems are different in nature. Maybe their problems are different in when it comes in strength. But nevertheless, they have a problem.
Right.
Sometimes even a small problem to a child, it's a big thing. For example,
it's
when a
huge.
Child goes to school and he gets into an argument with a teacher, for example, or he gets bullied at school, or one of his friends
it's
do something wrong to him.
Right.
So that leaves a mark and a stain on his soul, on his mentality.
Right.
And now when he comes home, he needs to find a parent that is very understanding, that is willing to work with him.
Sympathetic, at least.
Exactly. Well, to say the least, to be sympathetic about the case that he's going through. So if he does not find that in the house, it just bottles up inside the child.
Right.
And then, obviously, these are the things that cause children to have all these disorders.
Right.
Because,
and
you
outbursts.
Know, yeah. So they bring it from somewhere. They don't find an understanding parent in the house. And then things happen. Things go
bad on. Things most of the time.
Exactly. So we need to say, no, let's sit with our children and decide their problems.
Right. They say we will go on a quick break.
Imam As-Sajjad alayhi salam said, a child's right is to be kind to him when educating him, forgiving him, covering his mistakes, acting moderately towards him, and helping him.
Welcome back, to your listeners of IRRB English Radio. You are now listening into the program Islamic Upbringing. Today we are speaking about how important it is for a child's problems to be understood by their parents and how we should react to them. At the very least, how we should anticipate them so that we may help our children go through this difficult phase of their lives. They say, please enlighten us further.
Now, once we understand that children have problems and they need to be understood, they need to be studied, they need to be worked with, we have to be, in a way or another, not just parents. We have to be like, I don't know, physicians, doctors. We need to deal with them in a way where, because as parents, sometimes we can't differentiate between me being a parent in a position of power and me trying to help a child. So when you go to a doctor, for example, you could have done the most stupid thing in the world, right? You could have eaten the worst thing. You could have harmed yourself. But when you go to a doctor, the doctor's job is not there to sit and make fun of you or judge you or, I don't know, throw names at you. His job is to try to cure you and fix you to the best of his ability. His job is there to help, right? He passes no judgments, right? So you go to him and you got your hand stuck in a jar. His job is just to make sure he gets your hand out, right? He's not going to make fun of you for putting your hand in the jar in the first place. So he acts with you based on the fact that he needs to help, right? First and foremost.
That's the basic understanding of your guys' relationship with each other.
Exactly. So when it comes to parents and children, we understand now they have problems. They will go through problems whether sooner or later. Now, how do I deal with them? Because sometimes when parents find their kids have problems, and they find themselves not being able to deal with the problem, they point finger at the child. They start to blame the child for things, or they're trying to defame the child, or even, I don't know, sometimes it could even lead to hitting a child for making a problem or getting himself in a mess or having an issue of his own. So we're saying, well, that's not the right approach. As a parent, you need to be more understanding. You need to be more calm, more relaxed, more, I don't know, for the child to be able to trust you with their problems, no matter what they are. Unless you want to say, no, I am done, because sometimes we have this mentality, especially back in the day, when a child, especially teenagers, when they do something wrong, the parents say, you're not my child, I disown you.
Yeah, I disown you and cut all the relations.
Exactly. They used to do that back in the day. But we can't do that anymore. You know, we're not in
We shouldn't have done that in the first place, but...
Exactly. But, I mean... If logically speaking, that should happen in the first place. So we should come to the child and accept him for what he is, accept the fact that he has a problem, and we have to deal with it based on the fact that we deal with him based on compassion, love, and mercy, and all these things that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has given me. So instead of me giving them to strangers, first and foremost, I need to give them to my child. And sometimes as parents, we also, when we find out the child made a mistake and has a problem and we work it with them, sometimes we even use it against them.
That's what I want to say.
We keep reminding them.
Right. Or even another thing that I'm seeing parents do is when their child has a problem, like they're bad at reading perhaps, or some other problem that they have, they take that problem so personally and they're so offended by it. Like they equate the problem to the child and not the problem just being something the child also is facing.
Exactly.
And they absolutely go berserk on the child, and the child is just standing there like, what have I done?
Exactly. So that's what we're saying. So that's an issue. So as parents, you need to understand that this is not a right way of dealing with a problem.
Right.
So instead of making a child feel guilty, instead of blaming things on the child and pointing fingers at the child, or even reminding him of his mistakes and reminding him of the problem that he has, you need to be more understanding, more loving, more caring, so the child feels safe in your presence and in your environment.
Right. Dear Sayyid, I thank you for your time today and for your insightful knowledge. And I also thank you, dear listeners, for tuning in. If our dear listeners have any questions, comments, or some feedback that they want to give us, they can find us at our website, parstoday.com, or they can write us at our email, englishradio@irrb.ir. Alternatively, they can also find us on our various social media accounts under the call sign of Call of Islam Radio. Dear listeners, thank you for tuning in yet again.
Do you know what Islam is? It's a way of life for all. It is taught in the Quran, from big and small.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Stories from the past. Stories from the lives of the infallibles. Stories from different parts of the world. On the lantern.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah. Dear listeners, thank you so very much for being with us again on another episode of The Lantern. Alhamdulillah rabbil alameen that we've been given this chance and opportunity. I hope you guys find that the little discussions we have on the show beneficial. You know, one of the things that children do a lot is comparing. I don't even want to start with parents that compare their children with other children in front of their children. It's really detrimental for the child's mental health and growth. Please don't do that. But children also often have a habit of comparing the things that they have with other people. Let's listen to a short story about this, and we're going to be right back.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of Allah, the most compassionate, the most merciful, dear brothers and sisters, salam, peace and salutations of Allah the Almighty be upon all of you. So welcome to this episode of Lantern. As usual, we have an interesting story. It starts like this. A group of highly established alumni got together to visit their old university professor. The conversation among them soon turned into complaints about their stressful work and life. The professor went to his kitchen and returned with a large pot of coffee in an assortment of cups, including porcelain, plastic, glass, crystal, some plain-looking, some expensive, and some exquisite. The professor told them to help themselves to the coffee. After all the students had a cup of coffee in their hands, the professor said, "Did you notice all the nice-looking cups are taken and only the plain inexpensive ones are left behind? While it is normal for everyone to want the best for themselves, but that is the source of problems and stress in your life. The cup itself adds no quality to the coffee. In most of the cases, it's just more expensive and hides what we drink," the professor continued. "What all of you really wanted was coffee, not the cup. But all of you consciously went for good-looking, expensive cups and then began eyeing on each other's cups. Let's consider that life is the coffee and the jobs, houses, cars, things, money, and position are the cups. The type of the cup we have does not define or change the quality of our lives. Now, what is the moral of this story for today? Sometimes we fail to enjoy the coffee by concentrating only on the cup we have. Being happy doesn't mean everything around you is perfect. It means you've decided to see beyond the imperfections and find peace. And the peace lies within you, not in your career, jobs, or the houses you have.
The Lantern.
Under the light of lantern, we'll look at the story, which indicates a moral aspects of our life.
So, newsflash, apparently we as adults do that too sometimes. We sometimes compare ourselves and our own lives with others. Especially after this whole social media phenomenon appeared, we do that even more often. We scroll through Instagram, and we see people hashtagging, living their best lives, you know, glowing and drinking water and staying in their own lanes, good vibes only. And we're like, oh, darn, I wish I had her skin. I wish I had her figure. I wish I had his car. I wish I had their family, their home, their job, their career, their, you know, I don't know, lifestyle. Oh, they're such couple goals. Oh, they're so perfect. Oh, I'm so miserable. Oh, why can't I be as good as they are? And, you know, here's the thing. First of all, Instagram is full of baloney because filters. Secondly, filters. You know, on social media, we filter everything about ourselves, not just the imperfections that really we did not know even existed until Instagram filters appeared, but also the imperfections in our lives. No one is going to post, or well, some people do post every detail of their lives. But those who are keen on promoting themselves as, you know, life gurus and being really positive, influencers, quote unquote, I hate that word, by the way. Or maybe positive gurus are more realistic. Life gurus are more realistic. But those, they know that are good vibes only, living their best lives and stuff like that. They will not post about their bad hair day. Or even if they do, they're going to put it up in a really cute, messy bun with an adorable, oversized t-shirt and a, you know, duck face pose and hashtag messy hair, bad hair day. And you'd be like, girl, please. You know? They're not going to talk about the ugly side of their lives that often. Even if they do, they're not going to focus on it because that defeats the objective of posting about yourself for more likes and this and that. A lot of people are moving toward being more realistic, saying it as it is, so that more people can relate, and I think that's a wonderful thing. Also, I'm not saying that we should just post and share negative aspects of our lives. There should be a balance. There should be a sense of community and compassion. There should be a safe space for understanding, and there should definitely not be any comparison. There's a hadith from Imam Sajjad alayhi salam where His Eminence teaches us the only place it's okay for us to compare. And it's in the state of our spirituality and our wealth. Hear me out. Imam alayhi salam says, when it comes to our spirituality, our spiritual growth, and us bettering ourselves and self-refinement and whatnot, we should compare ourselves with those that are better. compare ourselves with the ulama, compare ourselves with the shahada, compare ourselves with the Ahlul Bayt, set them as standard and criteria, and try to, you know, the higher you set the bar, the more you will try and put effort into receiving it. In terms of our wealth, compare ourselves with those who have less. Why? Because it's about growth. It's not about who has more, who has less, who's doing better, who's doing worse. It's about growth. Okay? Everything in life. When I have a lot of wealth and I look to those who have less than me, I will practice gratitude. I will practice compassion. I will practice kindness. I will practice charity. I will practice appreciation for the things I have, big and small. I will practice thankfulness toward Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala for blessing me with all the things that I have. And when I look to those who are more than me in spirituality, I will practice discipline, principle, self-betterment. I will try harder. I'll put more effort into bettering myself and create a balance. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
That was all for today. Thank you very much for joining us. Inshallah, we continue this topic on the next episode. Till then, may Allah bless all of you. Fi amanallah.
Hello, I'm Mubarak Kenya, and a big welcome to this week's edition of Africa Today.
Stay tuned with Africa Today.
Africa Today.
Algeria recently recalled its ambassador to Paris following insulting remarks by French President Emmanuel Macron that disparaged the history of Algeria and its state institutions. The Algerian president has responded to the outburst by Macron and demanded France's total respect for his country. Hello, I'm Mubarak Kenya, and a warm welcome to another edition of Africa Today, a program which gives an alternative view on events taking place in Africa. This week's edition is focusing on the ongoing tensions between France and Algeria, following insulting remarks by French president against the North African country. In the second segment of our program, we'll talk about how the United States Military Command for Africa is being used by Washington to loot the continent's natural resources in the name of fighting terrorism. Stay with us till the end of the show and send us your comments.
Algeria rejects interference by France. Tensions between France and Algeria have continued to rise following remarks by French President Emmanuel Macron on the North African country's colonial past. Macron reportedly argued that the official history of Algeria has been rewritten not based on truth, but based on hatred against France. He also went on to question if there was an Algerian nation before colonization.
Now, in an interview, the Algerian foreign minister responded to the insulting remarks by Macron.
What was said about Algeria? Algeria had the opportunity to respond to it. We reject any interference in our domestic affairs. We don't accept value judgments on the formation of the Algerian nation. Algerian nation is an old one, deeply rooted in history, a nation that has contributed significantly to the prosperity in the region, the Mediterranean region, that has cooperated very, very efficiently and substantially with Europe, including France. Algeria has had diplomatic relations with France as well as with a number of other European nations. So we are at ease. All what relates to history, Algeria is a nation like any other nations, and therefore We don't think that that should be subject to any questioning or any debate.
Well, for more on the France-Algeria tensions, we contacted Raouf Farah, an Algerian activist and commentator. He's also the coordinator of Youth Engage for Algeria and a member of the pro-democracy organization Iftikhar. Welcome to our program, sir.
Thank you very much for your invitation.
Now, our first question, why is the French president adopting a confrontational policy towards Algeria at this juncture?
I think we should go beyond also the contextual analysis and interpret Macron's saying as basically what most politicians in France think about the relationship between Algeria and France. And I think Macron's really underestimated the grievances that could create it in France, but also in Algeria. And this is probably one of the reasons why we are here today to discuss that.
Thanks for that, Mr. Farah.
According to some projections, the French president is now under threat from right-wing possible presidential candidate Eric Zemmour. Macron's re-election strategy appears to try to win far-right voters by making the elections not about poverty or economic crisis, but instead about glorifying French colonialism and presenting mostly North African Muslim migrants as the enemy. And all these are linked to a strategy of Islamophobia.
The Algerian foreign minister responds here to speculation that Macron's outbursts are related to the upcoming elections in France.
There are a lot of analysis. I'm not a journalist to enter into speculative area, but I read what you read, I read what you say as journalist, and I am very much interested in understanding all the situation, and I certainly believe that all of the factors that are being mentioned by the media have certainly their role in the situation and in the crisis which was created. I'm not in a position to assess which of the relevant principles have played a stronger role than the others, but one can intellectually consider that all of them can be relevant in the motivations, but it's not up to me to determine the motivations of a particular person.
Now, do you think there is a link between the insulting remarks by Macron against Algeria and next year's elections in France?
Yes. I think there is definitely a link. The organization of presidential elections in France always brings the question of the tensions relationship between Algeria and France. But I think it's not the only factor one should take when analyzing what Macron has said. I think Macron's decision is really Macron's saying is really shows what many politicians in France think about the history of the country is in Northern Africa, and they see the adventure of colonialism as to a certain extent an enlightenment that brought to a certain extent again civilization to the region.
In another move to protest the patronizing remarks by Macron, Algeria closed its airspace to French military planes. This will complicate military operations by France in the mineral-rich Sahel region where Paris claims is fighting terrorists. Contrary to these claims, it's believed that the French army is in the Sahel to protect the country's economic interests in a region rich in uranium, gold, oil, and other minerals.
Mr. Farah, what's your take on the reaction by Algeria, including closing its airspace for the French military following the remarks by Macron?
One should know that Algeria opened its airspace to the French mission, not Barkhane, but a mission called Serval, which is the ancestor of the Barkhane operation. And since then, the Bouteflika regime from 2013 until his end in 2019 didn't really put an end to that. So I think the Algerian regime took advantage of this very tensious situation between the two countries to set back, take a step back on what was at that time a controversial decision. And I think after Macron saying it's pretty much normal to see that the Algerian ambassador is called back in his country.
Now, Turkey's foreign minister Mevlut Cavusoglu has slammed what he termed as Macron's extremely wrong and populist comments on Turkey and Algeria over colonialism. Now, Macron negatively mentioned Turkey in his anti-Algeria remarks. Is Turkey's increasing influence in many African countries worrying France?
It reflects the sort of leadership competition between Turkey and France when it comes to the Maghreb. And that's not only limits to the economic aspects, but also to the diplomatic aspects, to the geopolitical aspects of this bilateral relation between Algeria and Turkey. Here I have in mind the Libyan question, where Algeria is increasingly involved as one of the most important actors of the region. And Turkey is also pushing Algeria to be on her side on that matter. And France is having a very different position when it comes to the Libyan question. So this is just an example to show that there is clearly a competition between France and Turkey, and Macron's saying are immediately related to that.
Some analysts believe what is happening between Algeria and France is inseparable from the severing of relations between Algeria and neighboring Morocco, which normalized ties with the Israeli regime and betrayed the Palestinians. Is France pressurizing Algeria on behalf of the Israeli regime due to the move by Algiers to block the regime's observer status in the African Union?
I think Algeria will continue to defend the Palestinian voice within the international fora, including the African Union. And when there will be a chance to listen an increasing impact of Israel on the continent, it will do so. One of the triggers of the tensions between Algeria and Morocco, because Algeria has also cut its diplomatic ties with Morocco, is the normalization of Morocco's relationship with Israel after the signatory of the Abraham agreements. So all these factors are interrelated, and I don't see French pushing in particular for this agenda, because they know that, overwhelmingly speaking, the Algerian regime remains against anything that comes from Israel.
The Algerian foreign minister says he is optimistic that the current crisis with France will also be resolved in the future. Let's take a listen.
We have no doubt that the current crisis will be solved in the future, at any given time in the future, bearing in mind and taking into account all the principles, all the interests of the Algerian side.
Now, last question. Should we expect further escalation between France and Algeria in future?
A tipping point in this bilateral crisis between France and Algeria. So I don't think that it will go further deep, but the consequences of this crisis remain relatively inconsumable, in the sense that we don't know the full consequences of that. I think that it won't be limited to the military and to the recalling of the ambassador. there might be also other decisions taken, but these are, I would say, indirect consequences rather than direct decisions taken by the Algerian regime against France.
Well, thank you, Rauf, Algerian activist and commentator, for your insight on the current standoff between France and Algeria. Let's now take a short break, and when we come back, we shall focus on the activities of the United States Military Command for Africa. Stay with us.
Listening to Africa Today. Africa Today is an analytical weekly review of political, economic, and social events in Africa, the world's second largest continent. The series is broadcast every week on Saturdays and Sundays by IRIB English Radio.
In 2008, the United States Military Command for Africa, known as AFRICOM, was established and is currently headquartered in Germany. The formation of AFRICOM was followed by a new scramble for Africa, including plans by the U.S. to expand and strengthen its hegemony in this continent.
The U.S. claims that AFRICOM operations in Africa are about counterterrorism. However, since the establishment of this U.S. command, Africa has seen a massive increase in incidents of violence attributed to Takfiri terrorist groups. As if that is not enough, U.S. forces in Africa have killed many civilians while terrorists roam freely across the continent. An investigation by Amnesty International has revealed that the U.S. killed innocent civilians during an airstrike inside Somalia instead of hitting Al-Shabaab terrorists. Amnesty says such indiscriminate attacks in which civilians are killed or injured can constitute war crimes.
Targeting individuals who are not directly participating in active hostilities, indiscriminately attacking them and killing them, amounts to, you know, a breach of international humanitarian law, and that can amount to war crimes.
And to discuss more about U.S. military presence in Africa, we have contacted Tunde Osazua, a coordinator for the U.S. Out of Africa Network and a member of the Black Alliance for Peace. Thanks a lot, sir, for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Now, first question, what do you think were the secret objectives of the U.S. government when it formed its military command for Africa?
Well, the purpose of AFRICOM is to use U.S. military power to impose U.S. control of African land, resources, and labor to service the needs of U.S. multinational corporations and the wealthy in the United States. And U.S. military presence in Africa didn't begin with AFRICOM, but AFRICOM now formalizes that presence with better coordination and strategic focus for realizing the long-term geopolitical goals of U.S. imperialism in Africa, which includes beating out China and others in the battle for power and influence on the continent. Another objective is the long-standing effort to prevent the emergence of any independent African influence or force. And the war in the DRC is an illustrative example. The U.S. initially worked with Belgium to assassinate the first prime minister of the newly independent Democratic Republic of the Congo, Patrice Lumumba, because of the threat his leadership posed to U.S. and Western control of strategic raw materials in the DRC. AFRICOM brings this effort into the present day through military might.
The U.S. has fully militarized its so-called war on terror in Africa. Many security experts in Africa disagree with this approach dictated by the US, as it has only increased terrorism. Despite AFRICOM announcing that it's in Africa to combat terrorism, we have since seen a rapid increase of terrorism. What could be the reason behind this?
AFRICOM isn't in Africa to fight terrorism, and the US military presence is a destabilizing presence. Terrorism is actually a useful pretext for the US to assert its power. In that sense, AFRICOM has been a success. The United States has vastly expanded its power and influence on the continent through AFRICOM as it vies for full spectrum global dominance in the competition with folks like China and Russia. If the goal is to fight and end terrorism, AFRICOM is a woeful failure, as you've shared. The number of incidents of violence attributed to terrorist organizations have increased fivefold since AFRICOM was established 13 years ago. The ending terrorism is not the goal. Terrorism is a byproduct of imperialism, and claims of fighting against it are used for public relations purposes. Ending terrorism and liberating Africa from the clutches of U.S. imperialism means shutting down AFRICOM and removing all U.S. forces from the continent and the world.
Many innocent civilians, including women and children, have been killed during U.S. airstrikes in Somalia. AFRICOM arrogantly stated that it had not paid any compensation in Somalia for civilian casualties it had acknowledged since 2017.
Now, civilians have borne the brunt of AFRICOM operations in Africa, especially in countries such as Somalia, where the U.S. refuses to compensate the victims. Clearly, AFRICOM does not value the lives of African people. What's your take on this?
The lives of millions of African people are simply bargaining chips that are played by the United States in the new scramble of Africa, which is similar to what took place in the 1880s when the colonial powers fought over which of them would dominate which parts of the resource-rich continent. In Somalia specifically, AFRICOM has caused the murder of thousands and the displacement of hundreds of thousands of people. For AFRICOM, what matters more than Black or African lives is what Vice Admiral Robert Mueller, former AFRICOM deputy, admitted is protecting the free flow of natural resources from Africa to the global market. The U.S. has also used the framework of enemy combatants to decide that a victim is an enemy without having to provide any proof. This allows them to ignore the suffering of countless civilian victims and their quest for compensation, all in pursuit of U.S. interests.
Now, Mali and Guinea are two mineral-rich West African countries that saw military takeovers this year. The coup leaders in both countries claimed that they want to put an end to corruption and human rights abuses. But the military officers who led the coups in Mali and Guinea had close links to the United States and France, and this has raised suspicions about other motives behind these military takeovers.
In 2018, thousands of people in Ghana rallied in their capital, Accra, to protest a deal that would have given the United States military an expanded role in the country. A politician from Ghana speaks here during a protest march against U.S. military presence in his country.
If you allow for a permanent U.S. military presence in our country, we have seen where everywhere there has been permanent U.S. military presence, what it has attracted. It has attracted terrorism, it has attracted destabilization, and we don't want Ghana to be destabilized. We also say that this agreement is lopsided, it's one-sided, there's nothing in it for Ghana apart from the dangers.
Following the protests, the president of Ghana, Nana Akufo-Addo, categorically rejected claims that the United States will set up a military base in the country.
Let me state with the clearest affirmation that Ghana has not offered a military base and will not offer a military base to the United States of America.
Now, clearly, many people in Africa are opposed to the presence of U.S. forces in this continent. Now, will all the leaders listen to the people and demand complete withdrawal of U.S. forces from Africa?
Well, imperialism is a global system that requires the enforcement of certain conditions, and that's exactly why autocratic leaders are supported by the West. And Western imperialist projects. These governments are the neocolonial political cover for the West control of the land, labor, and markets of the colonized. So though many people in Africa are opposed to the presence of U.S. forces in their countries, a mass or a popular movement is needed to demilitarize and depose imperialism and militarism on the continent. And that really requires the construction of a mass-based geostrategic vision that prioritizes the removal of AFRICOM and other European military projects. That's why the demands of the U.S. Out of Africa campaign include the withdrawal of U.S. forces from Africa, the demilitarization of the African continent, and the closure of U.S. bases throughout the world. And that's crucial in this effort.
Well, there you have it. A mass movement is needed to eject U.S.-led imperialist forces in Africa. Thanks a lot, Mr. Tunde Osazua, for your insight. Well, that's it for this week's edition of Africa Today. God bless you all.
In the limelight. Senate Democrats rushed on Tuesday, 26th of October, to nail down the details of a groundbreaking tax on billionaires' wealth, part of an elaborate menu of tax increases to finance a significantly scaled-back bill that would strengthen the societal safety net and address climate change. The article you're about to hear has been written by the New York Times journalist Jonathan Wiseman, Emily Cochrane, Alan Rappaport, Katie Edmondson, and Zolan Kano-Young. The piece is titled, Democrats Hammer Out Novel Plan to Tax Billionaires and Corporate Giants. Stay with us for more. Democrats rushed on Tuesday, 26th of October, to nail down the details of a groundbreaking tax on billionaires' wealth, part of an elaborate menu of tax increases to finance a significantly scaled-back bill that would strengthen the social safety net and address climate change. Democrats' plans to pay for about $1.5 trillion in social policy and climate spending could prove to be the most innovative components of the party's domestic legislation, a top priority which was once envisioned as a transformative cradle-to-grave initiative to vault a stagnant working class into prosperity. Now, even as President Biden and his allies cut down the plan to ensure it can pass, even with Democrats' razor-thin edge in Congress, they are toiling to agree on new tax policies that could have far-reaching consequences. Among them is a measure Senate Democrats presented on Tuesday, 26th of October, that would impose a 15% minimum tax rate on corporations based on the profits they report to their shareholders, not what they show to the Internal Revenue Service, IRS. The billionaire's tax and the corporate minimum tax face skepticism among House Democrats, who questioned their feasibility, and both were likely to encounter legal and constitutional challenges. For the first time, billionaires would face a tax on their unrealized gains in the value of their liquid assets, such as stocks, bonds, and cash, which can grow for years as vast capital stores that can be borrowed off to live virtually income tax-free. The courts would have to determine whether unrealized gains in wealth can be considered income, which the 16th Amendment allows the federal government to tax. And even if they passed legal muster, the measures were all but certain to spawn fresh tax avoidance efforts. But with Senator Kyrsten Sinema, Democrat of Arizona, a crucial holdout on President Biden's plan, serving as a one-woman blockade against more conventional tax rate increases, Democrats appear to have no choice but to turn to creative revenue measures. I've always felt that success was giving everybody in America the chance to get ahead, and what we're dealing with here are flagrant loopholes in the tax code, said Senator Ron Wyden, Democrat of Oregon and chairman of the Finance Committee. They're legal, but I'm going to close them. Democratic leaders unveiled a final bill on Wednesday, 27th of October, hoping that it would pass the House and Senate, but several sticking points remained. Senator Joe Manchin, Democrat of West Virginia, seemed to torpedo a plan that would require banks to provide the IRS with more customer account information to help catch tax cheats, calling the idea screwed up and declaring it cannot happen. Dropping it would mean that Democrats would have to find another way to raise hundreds of billions of dollars the provision was estimated to generate. Senator Kyrsten Gillibrand, Democrat of New York, was trying to line up support, including from Senator Manchin, to beef up a federally paid family and medical leave provision that had been whittled down to just 4 weeks from 12. Senator Raphael Warnock, Democrat of Georgia, threatened to withdraw his support for the bill if, as expected, it dropped a provision that would expand health care coverage for the working poor in a dozen states like his that have refused to expand Medicaid under the Affordable Care Act. Senator Bernie Sanders, independent of Vermont, was still furious over the refusal of a handful of Democrats to give Medicare board powers to negotiate prescription drug prices. But overall, liberal Democrats were trying to make their peace with a stripped-down bill that would turn a once expansive vision for social transformation into a series of short-term measures, many of which would expire under a Republican Congress if history holds and the president's party loses seats in next year's midterm elections. I'd rather we put programs out there, and if people like them, then we should continue them as a government. And if for some reason they're not popular, well then, that also helps make some determinations, said Representative Mark Pocan, Democrat of Wisconsin and a leader of the Progressive House Democrats. Representative Pramila Jayapal, Democrat of Washington and the head of the Progressive Caucus, struck a pragmatic note. She said, look, the thing is, we would have been done with a very different bill a month ago if we only needed 90% of us, but that's not the case. We need 100% of us. Jen Psaki, the White House press secretary, acknowledged that the package would not contain everything that President Biden wanted. But she said the alternative to what is being negotiated is not the original package, it is nothing. Democratic leaders continue to frame the legislation as transformational, an heir to Franklin Roosevelt's New Deal and Lyndon Johnson's Great Society. They lumped in its $1.5 trillion in spending with the $1.9 trillion pandemic aid bill that passed last spring, and a pending $1 trillion $1 trillion bipartisan infrastructure measure awaiting passage in the House. We're hopeful and we're optimistic about the prospects of delivering something historic, transformative, and bigger than one could possibly have imagined on behalf of everyday Americans. Representative Hakeem Jeffries of New York, chairman of the House Democratic Caucus, declared on Tuesday. Ms. Jayapal said not all the provisions had been truncated. Child care subsidies should last 6 years, and home and community-based health care assistance could stretch even longer. But other measures have been cut. 2 years of guaranteed community college were jettisoned. A broad path to citizenship for undocumented immigrants was knocked out by the Senate parliamentarian. So Democratic leaders were trying to win approval to grant temporary legal status to some undocumented immigrants. An expansion of Medicare coverage to include dental, vision, and hearing care appeared likely to be cut back, if not eliminated altogether. So Senator Bernie Sanders was pushing for a $1,000 debit card as a bridge to a permanent program, particularly for dental benefits. A permanent extension of the generous child tax credit created for a year in March's pandemic relief bill was to be extended only another year. That left the tax increases that Democrats were cobbling together on the fly as potentially the most far-reaching aspect of the plan. Senator Kyrsten Sinema's refusal to accept conventional tax rate increases has played into the hands of Senator Elizabeth Warren, Democrat of Massachusetts and a longtime proponent of creative measures to break through the tax avoidance strategies of the rich. These problems cannot be fixed by raising tax rates, she said. The corporate minimum tax, for instance, plays off Elizabeth Warren's long-standing efforts to force companies to pay taxes off the profits they boast about to shareholders, rather than those they minimize for tax-paying purposes. The minimum tax unveiled on Tuesday was something of a substitute for initial efforts blocked by Kyrsten Sinema to raise the corporate income tax rate to at least 25% from 21%, still far lower than the 35% rate paid before President Donald Trump's 2017 tax cut. Under the plan, companies with at least $1 billion in profits, about 200 publicly traded corporations, would no longer be able to escape income tax altogether. The 15% minimum tax would also bring the United States into compliance with the standard recently set by the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development, OECD, to try to root out tax havens. Senate Finance Committee aides singled out Amazon, which over the last 3 years reported $45 billion in profit, including a record $20 billion last year, but paid an effective tax rate of just 4.3%. In 2018, they said Amazon did not pay any federal income tax. Senator Angus King, independent of Maine, estimated the minimum tax would raise $300 billion to $400 billion over 10 years. Importantly, Kyrsten Sinema blessed it as a common sense step towards ensuring that highly profitable corporations pay a reasonable minimum corporate tax on their profits. The details of the billionaire's tax were being hammered out on Tuesday night. Under the plan, Congress would impose a one-time tax on all gains in the value of tradable assets held by billionaires from the time they were initially purchased. That first hit would be huge, since men like Mark Zuckerberg of Facebook, Elon Musk of Tesla, and Jeff Bezos of Amazon sit on vast shares of the companies they created, which initially had a value of zero. After that, anybody with $1 billion in assets or who received $100 million in earnings for three